Welcome to episode 57 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. I'm Graham Lee, and this episode is the first part of a mini-series discussing the 1968 and 1969 NATO conferences on software engineering. It's sponsored by the members of my Patreon, which can include you. Software engineering is commonly thought to have had its genesis at the NATO Science Committee Conference on Software Engineering, held in Garmisch, Germany, in the week of October 7th to 11th, 1968. Certainly, the phrase software engineering was coined for the title of that conference, and NATO didn't already do software engineering. The conference was initiated by a Science Committee working group on computer science. Computer science itself was a new idea, having been named by an independent consultant, Louis Fine, in 1959. The ACM first put together a preliminary CS curriculum in 1962 to 1965, and eventually ratified it as Curriculum 68, the same year as the first of the NATO conferences on software engineering. This conference report has mostly gone down in history as a broadly cited starting point for the so-called software crisis. But what does it actually say? Before answering that, we need to contextualise the conference, beginning, I suppose, by addressing the elephant in the room: why NATO? The answer is simply that NATO represented the largest customer and a good chunk of the supply chain of computers and their applications at the time. Electronic computers had been invented a little more than 20 years earlier, and had found their first applications in the military. In Britain, the Colossus system provided brute force cryptanalysis to the Government Code and Cipher School, and in the United States, the ENIAC was funded to calculate artillery tables, and applied by John von Neumann to thermonuclear reaction calculations used to design the hydrogen bomb. By the end of the 1950s, the United States semi-automated ground environment defense system employed 800 to 900 programmers, more than half of the total workforce in the country. The project would grow to about 2,000 programmers over its lifetime. Many of the ideas of division of labor between hardware and software people, and between different software people, came from military projects. Computers are one of the ideal examples of military technology that becomes dual use through serendipity. NATO had the most to gain if people found better ways to make software more efficiently and quickly. Software engineering, the phrase, was, according to the conference report's preface and to the reminiscences of one of its editors, Brian Randall, a name chosen provocatively to suggest that software needed to be constructed with the same rigour as found in established engineering disciplines. This conference brought together people from academia and industry. About half were academics, nearly half from computing companies or consultancies, and a few government employees from computing-using departments, and people from North America and Europe, but mostly Europe. I count 37 European attendees or observers, and 24 from the United States and Canada. And a conference was organised into three work groups: software design, software production, and software service, in which they would discuss this notion of software engineering. Now, software engineering as a field almost implies the absence of hardware. At least, the absence of hardware is an important constraint on the design of software. This move, certainly a political one in a field of professional boundaries, in which programmers and analysts try to assert their importance in the computing world as peers or even superiors to the electrical and electronics engineers, by describing their own work as an independent engineering discipline in its own right. This move mirrors the slightly earlier development of academic computer science by minimising the contribution of the computer. The argument goes that as hardware gets more capable and flexible, the specific limitations of any one device become unimportant, and software designers can concentrate wholly on the problem domain. At the outset of the integrated circuit era, this might have seemed a reasonable bet, but in practice, there are few domains where it's true even now. Bob Barton made the opposite argument. He said, "In design, we should start by designing hardware and software together. This will require a kind of general purpose person, a computer engineer." It's unclear to what extent the software engineering conference at which Barton made that comment actually served to widen the professional gap between hardware and software, or whether the existing Taylorist fad for subdividing knowledge work in the mid-20th century had already made that split absolute. What we do know is that other than some hobbyists and brief flurries at the beginning of the microcomputing and Internet of Things eras, computer engineers haven't existed, and most organisations have separated their hardware and their software divisions, assuming they even designed both at all. From the very start of the report, the highlights section that serves as an executive summary, Randall's recollection and the conference as presented in the report that he edited, and presumably the executive summary that as editor he would have co-written, diverge immensely. Randall recalls the conference as being the place where the software crisis was named and acknowledged, and a field of software engineering bent towards its resolution. In fact, it seems that the word crisis hardly appears in the report at all. That conference attendee Edgar Dijkstra popularised the software crisis myth in the 1970s, and that the editors of the report were aware that it, quote, did not attempt to provide a balanced review of the total state of software and tends to understress the achievements of the field, end quote. Indeed, in another direct quote in the report from John Buxton, we find that 99% of computers work tolerably satisfactorily. And Ken Collins says, there are many areas where there is no such thing as a crisis. Although the wording here implies that the idea of a crisis was being discussed at the conference, at least. So what are the problems that the conference addressed? Interestingly, the highlights describe the problem crucial to the use of computers as being the so-called software or programs developed to control their action. I wonder what this means. I initially interpreted it as suggesting that the idea of software as a distinct entity was not yet settled. Perhaps some people thought of a computer as a general purpose device that you add software to for a particular application, while others thought of a computer as a component of a system that needs to be programmed to fulfill its role in that system. Subsequently, I changed my mind, and I think the editors might just mean to say that software is a technical term that the broader reaches of their audience won't know the meaning of in 1968. But I'm interested to hear how you interpret the idea of so-called software. The specific problems they describe as being relevant to their broader audience, that's academics, policymakers, civil servants, people who market computers, beyond the realm of people who directly work on software engineering. And these are direct quotes from the highlights section of the report. Firstly, the problems of achieving sufficient reliability in the data systems which are becoming increasingly integrated into the central activities of modern society. I interpret this problem as one of the earliest examples of the idea that software is eating the world. Second, the difficulties of meeting schedules and specifications on large software projects. The education of software or data systems engineers. And lastly, the highly controversial question of whether software should be priced separately from hardware. This is the advert break. It starts now. This episode is brought to you by me, Graham Lee, but really by you. Chiron Codex is a community of people who are learning how to become better software engineers by adopting AI augmentation in a thoughtful way. We aren't outsourcing our understanding to coding assistants like Claude or Codex, but becoming software engineering centaurs by using AI tools to improve our knowledge and the quality of our work. Join the community over on Patreon to find out about interaction patterns that improve your work with AI coding tools, running LLMs for software development locally, discussions of recent research in the field, and more. If you're a software engineer who's interested in the promise of AI tools, but skeptical about handing your skills over to the computer, this is the community for you. Go to patreon.com/chironcodex, that's C-H-I-R-O-N-C-O-D-E-X, now for more information and to join. Use the gift link in the show notes to get your first month of insider access completely free. Alternatively, you can show your appreciation by donating at Ko-fi. That's ko-fi.com/ChironCodex, ko-fi.com. Direct support by my audience is the only revenue I get for my work as a software engineer and communicator. So your support really means a lot to me and makes it possible for me to produce this podcast. Thank you so much. That was the advert break. It's over now. Remember that in 1968, a lot of software programs were batch jobs that ran on a whole machine with no time sharing. There were already a total of two computers at MIT that ran the CTSS time sharing system. Development of Multics, the predecessor of Unix, was underway. And Dijkstra's team had been working on the THE multiprocessing system for a while. But for the most part, while a computer ran your program, it did nothing else. That also meant that it wasn't running your compiler or your assembler. Programmers had to wait in line for computer time just like everybody else. So programs were written by hand, often with flowcharts as design aids. And a lot of debugging occurred in vivo, with programmers emulating the computer state in their head and checking that algorithms yielded the expected results. As we'll see in later parts of the conference, automated testing did exist, both at the unit and system level. Computer hardware had already adopted transistors and even some early integrated circuits. But in 1968, there wasn't the aggressive upgrade cycle that we see today, and it's likely that almost every computer that had ever been built by the time of the conference was either still in use or had had its parts cannibalized for another computer that was still in use. This includes computers based on thermionic valves, and including those valve-based computers that use non-binary storage, including valves that store octal and decimal digits. Many early computers were one-offs, designed to support the applications they were commissioned for, but there were some standard designs, and even one example of a family of compatible computers that could all, well, almost all, run the same software while offering different specifications or capabilities. This was the IBM System 360. Its operating system, OS 360, was released in 1965, and it required 44 kilobytes of memory when the System 360 family offered between 8 kilobytes and 4 megabytes. The conference report makes a note of this as a massive, expensive, staff-heavy project, as expensive to IBM as the project to develop the System 360 hardware that it ran on. But the world would have to wait until 1975 for Fred Brooks' detailed post-mortem in The Mythical Man Month. To give some idea of the scale of software production at the time of the conference, co-chair Dr. H.J. Helms estimates that there were 10,000 installed computers in Europe, a number that grew by 25 to 50% per year, with more than 250,000 analysts and programmers affected by the quality of software that manufacturers distributed for those computers. Alexander Dagapayev reports that a decade earlier, in 1958, a European general-purpose computer manufacturer often had less than 50 software programmers. Now, 1968, they probably number 1,000 to 2,000 people. What would be needed in 1978, he asked. Well, fast-forwarding further than that, there are now big tech companies with tens of thousands of software programmers who don't manufacture any computers at all. As noted in the highlights, it's large systems where ambition outstrips capability, in which the attendees saw a problem. With two attendees, Asher Oppler and Stanley Gill, the latter being one of the co-inventors of the subroutine, questioning whether customers should even be allowed to request computer systems whose complexity outstrips the capabilities of software creators. As the complexity of system grows, the number of errors introduced grows even faster. Doug McElroy and Collins both noted that the process by which software is created uses backward techniques and has a deservedly poor reputation. But why? The report proposes two underlying causes in the section on software engineering and society, which was written for a more general policy-making audience than the technical sections later. The first cause is, according to Cambridge University's Sandy Fraser, that software production isn't a linear path in which every activity takes a step towards working software, and that managers don't know what to measure or how to measure it. This is still a problem in 2026, as we saw with managers leaping on the tokens consumed metric without connecting that to working software produced by their organisations. The second cause, expressed by Robert Graham of MIT's Project Mac, which spawned the MIT AI Lab, is that projects go on for years using their initial poor understanding of the system, then deliver something that doesn't work as needed. Then they have to go back and start again. So even in 1968, it was seen that software construction needed more feedback than projects were accepting from customers. And indeed, that's a core topic in Section 3 of the report, a discussion on the nature of software engineering. Two papers, one by a Mr. J. Nash of IBM UK and the other by Dr. F. Selig of oil company Mobil, give schematic outlines of the software engineering process, moving linearly from analysis to design to implementation to deployment to maintenance. Both show activities occurring in parallel, unlike the phased approach that became popular among people who misread the Royce paper, with Nash's diagram in particular showing that technical support, documentation, test development and control and administration, i.e. project management, occur throughout the project lifetime. Multiple attendees noted the lack of feedback in both diagrams and the necessity to get feedback throughout the project. Bernard Galler, then president of the ACM, recounted stories of projects delivering poor quality results because of the lack of user feedback into the designs, and asked the question, why do these things happen? Why indeed? Selig himself points to feedback within the project, with external requirements informing software design and internal design constraints informing the requirements. Sandy Fraser's own description of the progress of a software activity presages iterative and incremental approaches like Barry Beam's 1988 spiral model, in which, to quote Sandy Fraser, each stage produced a usable product, and the period between the end of one stage and the start of the next provided the operational experience upon which the next design was based. With the benefit of hindsight, this sounds a lot like proceeding in short iterations, with time for retrospection in between them. In practice, without access to the whole paper, the conference report is comprised of working papers that were discussed in the conference but never published as a proceedings as such. Without access to the whole paper, we don't know if these iterations were weeks or months long, or who found the products to be usable. It could be that the output of an early iteration was a system requirements specification that was usable by a software designer, for example. Degapayev described an inverted pyramid model, in which a large number of application programs depend on a smaller number of service routines that sit on an even smaller base of control programs, buttressed by compilers and assemblers. Due to the lack of feedback between applications programmers and hardware vendors, who wrote the control programs and the service routines, there was a necessary middleware layer that adapted the service routines onto the application's needs, but which couldn't do anything to address performance issues. He described programming as still too much of an artistic endeavour, and suggested that more teaching was needed in structuring programs, designing and testing modules, and simulating runtime conditions. In other words, in designing testable software and in testing it. Assuming you listened from the start of the podcast and didn't just skip to here on the basis that I tend to take a long time getting warmed up to a topic, you will remember that there were three work groups at the conference: design, production, and service. At the actual conference, attendees disagreed that design and production of software were distinct activities. Report editor Peter Nauer says that the distinction is arbitrary and only exists to support the division of labour in software projects. Dijkstra says that we can't separate the two if we are going to do a decent job. And a consultant by the name of Kinslow says that design is necessarily iterative. He describes a failure on large projects as rushing to get the specification done, so skipping bits which you expect to be able to fill in later, but which are then incorrectly coded by 200 people, and then it's too late to correct the damage that's been done to the project. I've seen that failure mode on software projects in my career, which started in 2004, but probably, at least hopefully, much less frequently than the people in 1968 saw it. The money quote from the first part of the 1968 report is, to my mind, this from Doug Ross of MIT, who went on to invent the structured analysis and design technique. "The most deadly thing in software is the concept, which almost universally seems to be followed, that you are going to specify what you are going to do and then do it. And that is where most of our troubles come from. The projects that are called successful have met their specifications. But those specifications were based upon the designer's ignorance before they started the job." Think about this quote the next time you read a LinkedIn post on the benefits of spec-driven development. In this episode, we've covered the first 33 pages of a 226-page report, one of two reports from the NATO conferences on software engineering, and found that even then, software design was understood to need iterative feedback from users, integrators, and producers, and that everybody involved in a project had to share their knowledge and build the software based on the latest knowledge integrated from everybody, not on the designer's initial feels. Good news about the rest of this series is that the next page, page 34, is blank. But next time, we'll start to look at the output of some of the working groups and dig into the state of the design and production of software in 1968. Until then, remember that you can contact me with your feedback on this episode. You can go to the page on the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast, where the post for this episode is hosted. That's at sicperes.info/podcast. You can email me, grahamlee@acm.org, or you can join the Patreon to support my work and join in the chat there. That's at patreon.com/chironcodex. I'll talk to you again soon.